step up and has to take on security guarantees should come before any agreement.
Единственным механизмом принятия решений по использованию военной силы
has been verified as an age-slow fragmented constraint
sideline.
The threat that I'm worried the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, is the threat from within.
Zerreißt Europa, zerreißt Deutschland.
The Art of Diplomacy. The official podcast of the Munich Security Conference.
Hello and welcome to The Art of Diplomacy. I am your host, Florence Gaub, and today we are in episode 5. If you haven't listened to our previous episodes, I do invite you to check them out. They are as interesting as this one with very interesting people. But the most interesting person today, actually, that I'm going to talk with is Benedikt Franke. Welcome back to The Art of Diplomacy podcast. I want to have a chat with you about what's happening on this episode today. I met Sanna Marin.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Benedikt, obviously you know who Sanna Marin is, right?
She is brilliant. She is a great friend of the Munich Security Conference. We're lucky to have her as a member of our tech strategy initiative and, as a close friend.
She's a close friend. She has, for the listeners who don't know or maybe don't remember, she was the Prime Minister of Finland from 2019 to 2023. She was at the time the youngest prime minister the country's ever had. She was 34 when she took office. As you mentioned, she's obviously also involved with this illustrious group, the Tech Strategy Initiative. I do want to say, Benedikt, because you didn't mention, I'm also a member of this group, but a rotating member. So that means I'm going to be kicked out if I don't behave, I guess. And she also received a prize, I think, from the MSC, didn't she not?
She did in 2023. She and her Swedish colleague, Margareta Andersson, won the Kleist Award for the NATO accession that she and her Swedish colleague were so instrumental in pushing through.
First of all, I want to tell you that your Swedish pronunciation is insanely good. So I don't want to know why, but very, very impressed by that. Secondly, you put the finger on something that perhaps the audience might not remember, is that one of the things that's so remarkable about Sanna Marin's time in power is that she took Finland from decades of neutrality into NATO at lightning speed. No other country has changed direction so fast as she did. And so you gave both countries the prize for that. Can you explain a bit what the reasoning was?
I mean, first of all, the Munich Security Conference is a transatlantic organization, and hence NATO has always been at the core of what we do. Strengthening NATO, hence, is part of our raison d'etre. And seeing those two Scandinavian powerhouses join the alliance was just a wonderful moment and something that deserves recognition. Florence, this podcast is called The Art of Diplomacy. And I can only, you know, sort of harbor a guess at how much diplomacy was needed by a relatively young, first-time prime minister in a country like Finland that has been neutral for so long to get this record-breaking accession going. And so while we continuously, I think, make the mistake to talk about diplomacy as something that is only done between states, here I think that was true diplomacy between interest groups, between organizations, between part of the same government. And Sanna did a fantastic job at getting it through without many bumps and hurdles.
So that was actually one of my questions to her, was what is the secret sauce? So I met her in Hamburg. We were both in a TV show called Markus Lanz. The German speakers will know what it is. We had a lot of issues actually getting our two agendas synchronized. And then I realized, wait, next week we're on the same show. So why don't we just do it after that? So thanks to Lanz and Precht for lending us their studio on that occasion. So we did the show, then we went straight into the podcast. And she actually had three takeaways for what makes you a good diplomat. The first one is listening. And you know what I find interesting is that she's not the first person we interview to say that. The art of listening, of truly listening, is paramount. And she felt that was a skill she had learned in a previous career. And then know your opponent's or the other side's goals, and know also your own. So you know where are the red lines. I thought that was super interesting for her to break it down into these, you know, three pretty well actionable items. What makes you a good diplomat?
And you know what? We can actually go on and break down all three of those into even more buckets. I mean, listening is not just important to understand what the other side is actually saying, but to also make the other side feel welcome and appreciated and interesting. And that, I think, is really underappreciated in a diplomat's toolkit.
Yeah, it includes sometimes banal things like remembering somebody's name or
that
what
usually
like.
Helps actually.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised how many people don't remember my name.
Florence Gaup.
Okay, you passed. But also I think what I've read, also for instance, when you read Stoltenberg's autobiography about his time in NATO, I'm sure you've read it, where he talks about these little things that, you know, it's not the little things that get the thing through the door, but they do play a role, like what people remembering what kind of tea people like, or that they have a dog that was sick last time you saw them. So I think it's these human components that make diplomacy actually so hard, because it's not necessarily easy to listen. And I think all of us know that from personal experience. Yeah. So listening, I think, is a great skill.
It is a great skill. And then the other two sort of core skills that Sana has mentioned, you know, understanding the other side's objective and knowing one's own goals, they sound like such, you know, obvious things. And so many people get them wrong or don't even try. I don't want to mention names, but it seems to me as if, you know, current key decision makers, for example, involved in the situation in Iran, don't necessarily understand the other side's objectives or have even done a very good job at, you know, delineating their own goals.
Yeah, to me, the most pertinent example, I mean, good example is, of course, Camp David, the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. And the art, you know, what has gone down now is the Harvard negotiation technique, which essentially is nothing else but figuring out what does the other side want and why do they want it? Because sometimes that's where the secret is to success, right? So,
and then comparing it with what you are willing and able, again, two different things, to give, and then finding out what the delta is, if there is one, and whether that delta is manageable or impossible. And that really then makes the core of your strategy.
So, and that delta brings me back to a situation that, you know, sometimes we hear people say, oh, you know, Putin, it's just, why don't nobody call him and then we can just negotiate? You know, there has to be a delta, there has to be an overlap. And I don't think there is one at the moment. So it's not, you cannot negotiate your way out of everything.
True. In this fact, I think the delta is enormous, you know, sort of between what we are willing to give or what the Ukrainians are willing to give. It's their war and what the Russians are willing to give. That there is an enormous delta, and I guess diplomacy really is the skill of reducing that delta.
Yeah. And so that brings me back to Sana, because obviously Finland is the country, the European country that has the longest border with Russia, over 1,400 kilometers, I think. And Finland was a neutral country. So what's interesting, I think, about Sweden and Finland is that they have two different kinds of neutrality. So neutrality is not identical. Austrian neutrality is Swiss neutrality. Finnish neutrality was always based on the premise of defending Finland, and neutrality during the Cold War helped Finland defend itself against Russia at the time, Soviet Union. And they flipped enormously fast, right? From a decade-long tradition of no NATO whatsoever affiliation. I mean, they had a partnership, but we're not, the membership was never on the cards. And then within 3 months of the invasion, they applied for NATO membership. It was the fastest that's ever happened. And also they got through the door faster than the Swedes. So can you talk to me a little bit about what makes Finland so special in this larger NATO context? And why is it an asset actually for NATO to have Finland in it?
I mean, it's an enormous asset because of their, I guess, experience in facing Russia, their enormous resilience. The Finnish society is used to debates about warfare and the Russian threat. They have had decades of practice in increasing the resilience of their critical infrastructure, their societal operating model, and everything else that makes Finland Finland. And they have an enormously impressive pride and reputation when it comes to facing an enemy as an underdog. I you know, there are actually quite a lot of jokes about their self-perception. There is a story, and I'm not sure if it's true, but if it is true, it's great, that a Finnish president gave a little painting to an American president. And that painting was entitled Four Finnish Snipers. And it showed a forest and nothing but a forest. And so that American president, and I'm not going to mention any names, looked at that picture for like minutes upon minutes and said, oh, you guys are so good. I can't see a single Finnish sniper in there. The president only said, you know, that's the point. But afterwards, he confessed that there wasn't a single Finnish sniper in that picture. It was just a picture of a forest. But the point is a larger one. Yes, it's a funny story, but that, you know, Finnish snipers have a reputation. And so there is that joke that Sweden joined NATO, but NATO joined Finland. It is not just their military assets. It's really also their badass reputation, if I may say that. And their philosophy in facing up or, you know, sort of countering Russia.
100%. And the Finnish colleagues told me they have so many visitors coming to Helsinki, asking them, you know, a gazillion things about how do you do this? How do you do that? Everybody wants to learn from Finland. How can you have this, you know, total security concept, which essentially boils down to every nurse knowing where they should, or kindergarten teacher, where they should take children in case of an attack and all that. And it's completely natural and normal to them. And yet it's not a highly militarized society. Like, you don't see people walking around in fatigues. And I think it's that paradox that some people looking in from the outside find interesting, compelling, and worth learning for, I think.
Yeah, and flipping a society from one model of, you know, facing up to Russia to another in a couple of months is something that Sanna and her government really need to, you know, get a lot of credits for. And, I mean, they got the Kleist Prize, but, you know, all things considered, I think there are more important prizes out there. And yeah, they really deserve our appreciation for their diplomatic skills.
She also got the Helmut Schmidt Future Prize that I'm happy enough to receive. Actually, she makes this prize worth having. I think it's an amazing recognition of my work. But the fact that she got it, I think, makes it so much more impactful, I think. What I found interesting in the conversation with her was towards the end, I asked her to share a personal anecdote. And she was free to choose whatever. Like I told her before, I'm going to ask you that, so maybe come up with something. And, you know, I didn't think that was a particularly pertinent question. I mean, depends on whatever people make of it. And then she started telling me a story that I don't want to share now so that the audience actually listens to the podcast.
Is it at the end of the podcast and people have to stay,
yes,
you know, tuned in until the very end? It's very clever of you.
That's exactly the idea. But she was telling a story about her daughter, about how she met President Zelensky. And then someone, I realized she's welling up. She had tears in her eyes. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, there is this very professional, very experienced woman who's led her country into NATO, steered it through the pandemic and other things. And she's obviously, you know, she's a badass. She knows what she's doing. And here she was telling me a story that obviously was very personal, very emotional. And I was super touched that she opened up to me like that. So that was quite a moment. So yeah, if you want to hear it, you have to listen to the very end.
I certainly will.
Benedict, I have one last question, because you've mentioned to me before that when you've been to the Munich Security Conference 10 times, you get some kind of medal or something. How many times has Sanna been, do you know? Will she soon get the MSC returnee medal?
She will get that medal, but I don't think it's 10 times yet. So she has to come back, and that's not a bad thing.
I think she will. So thanks, Benedict, for joining me today. And here's my conversation with Sanna Marin. Sanna, first of all, welcome to the podcast. We're having a bit of a Finnish moment, I think, in continental Europe at the moment, looking at your country to learn a great deal from you. Perhaps people don't know this, but Finland has been now 9th year in a row been ranked happiest country by the UN Happiness Index. It's based on high trust in institutions, strong welfare state, low crime and high life satisfaction. So it's not a survey whether people think they're happy. It's more profound. And other European countries are marveling at this because you have a really long border, 1,340 kilometers border with a very difficult neighbor, Russia. How do you explain this apparent paradox? How come Finns are such a happy people with such a neighbor?
Well, I have been, of course, asked this question many times, and I've always answered that if you tell Finnish people that we are the happiest in the world, we don't actually believe it, because we are not very cheerful. But as you explained, it is much deeper kind of happiness that the statistics tell us. And of course, it is to do with the Nordic welfare model, Nordic welfare society, that enables everybody to choose their own paths in life. So every child will have a good education and opportunities that you might not otherwise have if you don't have wealth or a background that will support you. So of course, that happiness that comes within the society and the structures that help everybody to build their own paths and decide their own future, I think that is the key there. And also it builds trust to one society. And as a prime minister, I was able to enjoy that deep trust that we have in our society in a way that people participated voluntarily in the first phases of COVID when everybody was scared. But because we trusted each other, our institutions, also the trust that people, citizens showed that they're politicians, it was extremely helpful. So I would say the structures that are within the welfare society, the deep trust that we share together, and also maybe the fact that we might be more satisfied with less because of the difficult history that we share with our difficult neighbor, Russia. We have had fought wars with the Soviet Union, and we have lost a lot of land, lives, and every family has those stories of hardships that we have faced. So maybe we are also a bit more satisfied what we have and a bit more happy what we have, and not always seeking something better and greater, because we also know that there are those harder times behind us, and those harder times might also be in front of us. So let's be happy what we got now.
Sounds like a winning formula. And because one of the things you describe is, you know, the freedom to carve your own path in life, but then also trust. And trust is, of course, kind of like taking a loan out on the future, a positive loan, which brings me to the other point. You know, I'm also a futurist. I like to think about the future in general. And I always say Finland is the champion when it comes to strategic foresight, because no other country in Europe has your institutions, you know, in parliament and the foresight report and all that. Do you have an explanation why Finland is so future oriented?
I think it's because of our past. Like I said, because we have extremely difficult past and history, and it was never easy for Finnish people. We are up there in the north, and from the beginning, it was always hard. It was a survival, always. So I think we need to be prepared, and we need to look ahead in a way that if the worst things happen, how can we be best prepared? So I think those are the reasons behind that.
So you're imagining the worst, but you're also working towards the best, which is quite interesting. So I've prepared the word. So Finland's, I'm not going to say military posture, because it goes far beyond that, but the way you think about resilience and defense, what is translated as total security concept, kokonaisturvallisuus.
I think that was perfect.
That was perfect. Thank you.
Kokonaisturvallisuus.
Wonderful.
Very good.
Which is, of course, a concept that makes sure that defense is not the job of somebody in government. It's everybody, which is why, you know, I work for NATO Defense College. We have this joke, the Swedes think they joined NATO and the Finns think NATO joined Finland, because actually we all want to be a bit more Finnish in this. So what do you think? I mean, you are Finnish, and not just any Finn, you are a prime minister. What would you think are lessons that we can learn from your country in this regard?
Well, I think, like you said, the overall security architecture, that everybody plays a role when it comes to security. And we are a small country with 5.5 million residents. So we know that we cannot play with big force or a big population. We have to rely on each other, and everybody has to work for the sake of security. And everybody can also provide security. And also when Finnish people are asked, how willing are you to serve your country or serve in the military forces if something happens? We are always ranked very high because we understand that we rely on each other because we are so few and nobody will come to our aid if we don't do it ourselves. So of course there's many things that rest of Europe and the Western world can learn. But we also know that we need the rest of Europe and we need our trusted partners and we need our allies in NATO because we are small. So I think all of us in Europe, we need to understand that we are strong when we are united, when we are together. We are a big economy, the biggest in the world. We can also be big, big security providers to each other if we just work together and work as united as possible. And there, it's not a coincidence that Russia is trying to separate our decision making and trying to separate us. And they want to see Europe cracking in its edges everywhere because they understand that we are strong when we are united and we are weak when we are not.
So let me move now to your personal experience being in government. And my first question is about the pandemic. You became prime minister and then shortly after a huge surprising event occurred that we had very little, institutional memory to deal with. What did COVID teach you about leadership that you didn't know before?
Well, first of all, COVID taught me, because I think that many can relate, that we want to think that our government or our institutions or people up there somewhere, they know what to do in a crisis situation or serious situation. They know what to do. But I think COVID caught everybody on surprise, also the governments, also leaders, public officials, health officials. And it taught us that we weren't as prepared as we thought. And I remember those first weeks of COVID, how difficult it was to lead when the virus was unknown. We didn't know much about the virus, how it spread, what kind of disease it caused on a short term or long term. And at the same time, we had to implement extremely heavy restrictions to our citizens. And in Finland, I don't know how it was here in Germany, but in Finland, we had to do that with tools that we didn't actually have. We had legislation concerning infectious disease. So we had that legislation on place, but it wasn't very throughout. There was a lot of tools that were missing and we didn't have those on place. So what I was mentioning before about deep trusts that actually helped us a lot because citizens, they voluntary based safeguarded each other. They stayed awake from meeting with other citizens or other people. Also the employee and employer organization, they voluntarily helped and said, go to remote work. And they were very flexible, even though we haven't those tools that we could force them, but they voluntarily helped. So I think the deep trust that we had within our society gave us those tools that at the beginning we were missing and we had to build when the pandemic continued. But it taught me how important it is to have that kind of reliance on others and also the trust that we have within our society. And also just the understanding that in a moment of that kind of crisis, also the leaders and the officials and all the people on top, they can froze. Mm-hmm. And then you have to lead and guide a country through that kind of situations.
You know, I've read that how much you like or dislike surprises, or not like, but how well or not you respond to it has a neurological explanation for it. Would you say you, like outside of COVID, obviously, do you think you're somebody who likes surprises or they don't bother you so much?
I don't know. Everybody likes nice surprises.
Well, yeah.
Like surprise birthday party or something. That's nice. But of course, you don't like the kind of surprises that takes you off guard and that are not the nice ones. But in life in general, I would say I'm a type of person that don't want life to be predictable. I want life to be filled with surprises also, because I think that is something that makes life worth living. But of course, I exclude pandemic and wars and everything, those nasty things that nobody wants.
Goes without saying, but I think that, so I think studies show that if you basically inoculate yourself with surprises at a lower level than war, pandemic, you will also be able to respond faster to something bigger. One case in point, I live in Italy, is that Italy, for instance, is a country where we have a lot of surprises and not all of them positive all the time because of the infrastructure and stuff. And Italians in studies, you can see they have much higher tolerance for uncertainty than, for instance, Germans, where you would say, well, in Germany, everything works. So the Germans are, you know, allergic now to uncertainty and surprise. So I think there's a bigger thing here that has to do with culture, also with neurology, but you know, how we deal with the unexpected aspects of the future.
I think that that might be true because, for example, of course, it is maybe a silly example, but if you expect that your public transportation always arrives to the point, to the minute, and then it doesn't, it makes you unease. Mm-hmm. You don't know why, what is wrong, why doesn't it work. It might make you a bit angry or upset as well. Why doesn't this function the way it should function? But if you live in a culture or in a situation where that's typical, then you can also relax a bit. Oh, well, it will come within a 5 minutes or 15 minutes. And then also the other people will understand why you were a bit late of your meeting or from work, because they also live in the same society where not everything always functions to that punctuality. So you can relax a bit. And I actually like that, even though I'm Finnish and Finnish people are quite punctual. And usually the first persons to enter a room of a meeting and the Swedes are the second ones and then maybe the Germans. But I also like that kind of idea and mindset of not being too strict, because that also makes you a bit nervous and a bit unease.
So on the notion of mental flexibility, I would like to ask you, not so much on why you changed your mind about NATO membership. Now, we know that, you know, Finland was, and not just, you know, Finland decided to, I think it was also consensus across Finnish society for a really, really long time that NATO membership is not something that's of benefit or interest to Finland. And then you led Finland famously into NATO. I'm not so interested in the reasons. I think the reasons are pretty obvious, but I'm wondering, you know, what does it feel like mentally, emotionally, I don't know, psychologically, to change your mind in such a radical way? Or was it actually not radical, but gradual? Was it not February 22 that you suddenly woke up, or was it a longer process? What does it feel like to change your mind? Which is, I think, testimony to mental flexibility, but what does it feel like?
Well, I think it was a collective shift in Finland, because we shared that collective memory and that collective mindset, the memories of the difficult times that we have had, especially because of the wars. So it was about security. And then we shifted our mind collectively when Russia invaded Ukraine, and it was not safe not to join anymore. So it was a collective shift. And I think the psychology is also linked to that, of the collective memory and then the collective shift of mind. And it was because of security. But my mind actually shifted about a year before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started. And it was because of, as a prime minister, I was sitting in those European Council meetings and international meetings where I saw that we, like concretely with my own eyes and heard the discussions, that we weren't on the tables where the decisions were made. And we weren't in the important meetings where the European security architecture was molded. So my mind shifted about a year before, even though I was against NATO membership in our elections, like my party was, and majority of Finnish people and also political parties. Just because I noticed that so concretely. And then I was wondering, and I was discussing this with my close advisors about a year before the full-scale invasion started, that how can we shift first our party's positioning towards NATO from negative to positive? How can we have the discussion within the country? And we were discussing this well way before the invasion started, but I could have not imagined that Finland would join NATO during our governmental term, because when we started, like I said, majority of Finnish people and political parties were against. We had just approved this paper that every government creates together with the president. So it's a parliamentary work, but also includes all the institutions of our security policy and foreign policy. And there it was stated that Finland has the opportunity to join NATO if it wishes so, but there wasn't any statement that we would join NATO. So I would have not imagined that this would happen during our governmental term, but it was because of Ukraine. The security situation changed, and then we had that collective shift of mind.
You know, why I'm asking is because changing one's mind, I think, is often seen as lack of
weakness.
It's seen as a weakness, but I think it's actually a sign, on the contrary, of intelligence. But I think a lot of people, especially now, you know, with social media and you get all this information, so you become more and more entrenched in your opinion. And I would like for people to learn to change their mind easier. This podcast is called The Art of Diplomacy. Do you have any ideas or recommendations? How do you stay mentally agile, flexible, capable of changing your mind when it's necessary?
Well, I think maybe we should start at the beginning to understand that we don't know everything, and that we are not, we don't like have that greater wisdom. Not anybody has that. And also we shifted our mind and strategy many times during COVID. In our government, because when we learned new things, we had to shift our strategy and we had to make new decisions and we had to make different decisions that we had made before. And I think it is a poor strategy to always stick what you decided before when you got new information and when you learn something. I think it is wise to change your mind then. But of course, there are different things, especially in politics. Don't ever sell your values, but shift your strategy if it supports your values, and then you can also change things.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to the most memorable moment of Finnish foreign policy, at least from where I'm sitting in NATO, is the accession of Finland to NATO. After one of the member states quite openly said we were not in favor, and that was Turkey at the time. Mm. Can you tell me a little bit about you can't tell me all the details, but tell me a little bit about...
Tell me all the details.
How you swung that.
Well, first of all, Turkey didn't have a problem in such with Finland.
Yeah.
It was Sweden that they were pressuring, and it was to do with politics. I think this is my interpretation, personal interpretation of the situation, that President Erdogan wanted to use that momentum to maybe have other negotiations with US that were nothing to do with the Swedish accession to NATO, and also used Sweden as a political tool to win the elections that were coming in Turkey, and maneuvering in that situation. So there were actually other plays on the background, and I think it was very visible from the beginning. And I remember discussing with my Swedish friends and of course my counterparts, and saying to them that don't give in to every demand that Turkey has, because they will only ask more. It will become this bazaar-like situation. So do some adjustments that you need, but don't give in on everything, because it will never end. And we knew that it was also about the fighter jets that the Turkey wanted to discuss and negotiate with the US. And they were pressuring the situation to have totally different... isolated from the actual negotiation. So it was maybe not an act of diplomacy, but it was an act of politics that was happening in that ratification process.
Well, but you succeeded. I think it is diplomacy. I mean, diplomacy is negotiating to achieve, I think, or that's how I define it. But did your perspective on diplomacy change once you became a prime minister or after your experience in government? Or have you expected negotiations in general to be more or less what it was?
Well, of course it has changed. And of course I also learned as a prime minister and in Finland, because we always have coalition governments. So not only in the international politics, but because we always have coalition governments negotiating is in the room every single day. You always have to negotiate about every single thing with your coalition partners, other parties. First, you write the governmental program, but there's always so many things that you cannot agree then, or there might be some details that you have to negotiate afterwards. So I think that is the way that you learn how to negotiate. And it was a difficult period because we had very ambitious governmental program that we, I'm a social democrat, that we wanted to put on place. But then also the difficult things that happened, the pandemic and the difficult negotiations concerning that, and then the Russian invasion of Ukraine and our NATO accession and energy crisis that followed and high inflation and everything and the negotiations within the European Union because of these situations. So of course I also learned to negotiate because I had to negotiate almost every day. So it is an art that you also learn.
It is an art that you train, maybe.
So you don't born as a good negotiator. You learn that.
What are two or three things that you like, skills or elements of the skill that you can share?
Listen to others and find out what they want. I think that is the number one thing, whether it is the multi-annual framework negotiations within the European Union or whether it is some situation somewhere else or maybe even I don't have the experience of peace negotiations myself, but what I've learned, you have to understand what the other person or the other side wants. And then when you know that, then you also know where you can find the red lines and where is the part that you can actually negotiate. Mm-hmm. And also what helps negotiations is knowing what you want. If you don't know your own values and if you don't know your own targets and aims, then you don't know your red lines and where to maneuver between those. So know what the other person wants, know what you want. And then I think the art or the skill comes how you combine these, how you find the compromises, or in the best case scenario, the consensus of these different perspectives. So you know what is the area where you can work and where you can find the compromise. I think those are the things that you need to have to be a negotiator.
I think a lot of people think negotiation is about winning, but I think what you're describing is it's much more iterative process, and ideal is that both sides walk away with.
Yeah, and if both sides don't walk away with them understanding that, okay, I agree to this, then it won't last. Mm-hmm. So you can, of course, sometimes you can use your power in a hard way. And of course, in the international diplomacy and international situations, there are many times also situations where there are much stronger countries with much stronger positioning, and they can force the others to their will. Is it actually very wise in the long run? I don't think so, because if the other side feels that I didn't get anything out of it, or I was forced, or I didn't actually agree even though I agreed, it won't last. Mm-hmm. So the best outcomes are those where others, like different sides, feel that, okay, it was difficult, but I agreed to this and I will stick to it. Then it will last time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I used to work a lot on the Middle East, and I looked at a lot of conflicts that we still see now in the Middle East, and I always call them conflict heirs, like descendants of conflicts that weren't properly negotiated. And I think that brings me to Ukraine. You know, I think people don't understand that it's not just about peace no matter what. It has to be a negotiated deal that both sides can walk away from thinking, oh, I'm okay with that, more or less. And I think the art of getting there is what you just described, is much harder than people realize.
Mm. The problem with the situation in Ukraine is that Russia don't want peace. Mm. And that's the thing that you would need. So I think Russia would need to feel much more pain now and they need to feel that this war is costing them a lot. And when they feel the pain, when they feel the cost, then they will also have the initiative to go to the peace negotiation table and agree to something. If they don't feel the pain, they don't have any initiative. And I think this is the problem now that we are facing. So there's no such terms to put on a paper that both parties or both sides could agree and stick to. Because of course, if Russia would get everything that it wants, then it might be satisfied. But of course, we cannot allow that to happen. And Ukraine would never agree to that.
Yeah.
So I think we need to push Russia and we need to show them that there is a heavy price and a high cost of this war if they don't agree to peace.
Which brings me to a video clip I saw of you. I can't remember where it was, but you were asked when or how does the war in Ukraine end? And then you had a bit of a like an ironic laugh and you said, well, when Russia stops the fight, that's how it ends. Or something.
Or when Russia leaves.
When Ukraine. Russia leaves. And so I thought it was quite funny also because, you know, the way you laughed was just the question was kind of obvious. But which brings me to your personal style. You said yourself, you know, Finns are perhaps more punctual and direct and all that, and you are direct. Do you think, is it an asset? Is it irrelevant? Has it worked against you when it comes to diplomacy and public communication?
Well, I think you can be both things. You can be at the same time direct and tell what you want. For example, as a leader of a country, I would tell what is the goal or the aim or the target that Finland has, and you can be direct about that. But at the same time, you can of course also be respectful and you can listen to others. So it doesn't exclude one another. And I think it helps, especially these days when there's so much unpredictability in the world and situations that we couldn't even imagine 3 years ago or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago. Now every day, I think there's another catastrophe happening and things are said and done that you would have not imagined before. And I think the directness also serves this time. But at the same time, you have to have the capability and hope and send all my best wishes to all the leaders out there that have to now deal with this unpredictable and extremely difficult geopolitical world where we live. I hope they have great nerves and a lot of stamina to hold on to this difficult times.
So let's end on a positive note. I told you I was going to ask you about a personal moment in international politics that touched you. You told me before we recorded that it was going to be positive. So enlighten me. What was a personal moment that came to your mind?
Well, I don't know if it's like a moment of international diplomacy, but it was a moment of international, even though it happened in Helsinki. But I have a fond memory of President Zelensky visiting Helsinki and the presidential castle where he had bilateral meetings with the president and also me as a prime minister. And I didn't have a babysitter at that moment because my daughter was just under 2 years old when I took that office. And then she just turned six when I ended. I didn't have a babysitter for that day to Emma. My mother, her grandmother couldn't look after her and her father was maybe traveling for work. And the daycare wasn't, the teachers had a free day or some kind of day where they learned new things or something. So the daycare wasn't there. And then I had to take Emma with me to the presidential castle. And I remember we had a bilateral meeting with Zelensky. And at that time, my daughter was somewhere wandering in the presidential castle with my advisor and a person from there, and she just had picked a flower, and when we ended, she came to the room to President Zelensky and handed him the flower that she had picked somewhere in the presidential castle. And I think that was just an adorable situation and a fond memory. And I also have photos of that situation. And she actually understood very well who Zelensky was and what was going on in Ukraine. And so.
Wow, that is a very moving story.
It was really moving.
I'm getting
moment.
Goosebumps, actually. Yeah. And I can tell you, it's still, yeah. you're thinking about it. It's a very moving yeah. story. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you for being with us today, also for sharing, especially the last story. I think it's a nice story to end on, because I think the only way is forward. And I think that's something we can also learn from you and from your country.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Sanna.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Art of Diplomacy, a podcast of the Munich Security Conference, produced by Studio Bummens. The show is hosted by Florence Galp and Joshua Jaffa, with original music by Jakob Ilja. The Munich Security Conference production team includes Andreas Block, Marie Zeisler, Judith Sorden, Noor Saad, and Annalena Enold. For more on this year's Munich Security Conference and for footnotes and references for this episode, please consider our show notes. Most of the conversations in this podcast were recorded at Bayerischer Hof at the Munich Security Conference in mid-February 2026. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show and leave a review. That's it for today. Thanks for listening.